So, today is Father's Day. And I struggle a little with Father's Day because my own father left when I was very young. But I grew up with my grandfather, who was a kick in the pants. That man has taught me so much. I've been thinking about Tobit's father, or Tobit and his son Tobias, and all of the things that he was trying to convey to his son. And I thought about my grandfather. And I remember how back in college, a young man invited me to go fishing with him on a date. And so we went out on the boat, and he was fussing, like worried that I would get squeamish, or I would be upset, or I would be worried about the fish, or that I wouldn't want to touch the worms or what have you. I want to take a moment to acknowledge that she is going to a safe place because she's finding this a little bit upsetting, and she made a choice to remove herself with great love so that she could have space. And I want to acknowledge that and honor that choice that she made. So there was a point years ago that this young man did not know where my grandfather used to take us fishing. He loved fishing. He used to go bass fishing. He used to go catfish fishing. He would even make his own gooey, nasty, smelly dough balls. You know what you got to make for catfishing? And I remember when I was young, he took us fishing off the Berkeley Pier, my brothers and I. And we had the pole hung over the water, and the line just sat there. And when my grandfather wasn't looking, I would sneak up to the pole, and I would tug on the line on the pole so it would make it look like it was wiggling. And he would jump, and he would run forward. He'd say, "I think we got one. I think we got one." And I would just giggle. I thought that was the funniest thing. So you would think that perhaps I wasn't listening and I wasn't paying attention, or I wasn't acknowledging what my grandfather was trying to teach me. But I remember being on this fishing trip, and I caught a trout. It was like this big. That's how big it was. That little trout I caught in the lake, it was this big. And the gentleman I was with was like, "Oh, here, let me help you with that." And I said, "No, I got this." And I killed that fish. And I gutted it, and I cleaned it, and I said, "Where's the frying pan?" And I watched that man's jaw drop. He hadn't seen a woman that knew how to do that before. I saw another man's jaw drop similarly when I told him I had to change my oil. And he said, "Well, where do you get that taken care of? Do you go to Jiffy Lube or something?" I said, "No, I got this." Because my grandfather had taught me to do tune-ups on my own car, and he taught my mother. And so between the two of them, I learned. I didn't even use a jack. You know that? I drive it up on the pavement so that it lifts one side of the car higher than the other. Because a jack can fail and you can get squished, but the pavement will never cave in. The pavement will never cave in. And you just get under the car and you change your oil, change your sparks, change your oil filter, your rotor cap, your rotor. I've done all that. I used to keep a spark plug gapper in my purse, just so that people, when they asked me about it, I could say, "Yeah, my grandfather taught me how to change my sparks. You never know when you're going to need to gap them." Jaws dropped. We listen to the stories that our parents tell us. We learn those lessons, even though we don't think that we hear them, even though they may not think that we hear them. We hear them, we learn them. So in this story, this is part of the Apocrypha. This is a story that was written in Greek in that 300-year gap before Jesus was born, but after the Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament, was canonized. There's a 300-year gap there. And most of these stories come out of places that are far from Jerusalem, that are far from Israel. And they're written by Jewish people who were living abroad, who had been exiled but never returned, and were living oftentimes as ethnic and religious minorities in much larger empires that were not always friendly to them. And so this is one of those stories. Tobit is not a historical novel. It's got a lot of historical details in there, but really, if you look at kind of when it starts and the things that he refers to, he would have lived to 400 years. That's not possible. But what he's talking about is what it's like to try and survive as a cultural entity in a larger empire that is not friendly to you. How do you maintain your cultural heritage? How do you maintain your practices? How do you maintain your religion when you're not allowed to practice openly, or there's a threat of doing so openly? And an even bigger question is, most of Judaism at that point was temple land Judaism. Everything revolved around temple worship, going to the temple, yearly sacrificing at the temple, social life centered around the temple, all the big rituals happened at the temple, and everything revolved around the promised land, Jerusalem, Judah, and Israel. So the big questions in apocryphal literature are not only how do you maintain your cultural identity, but how do you continue to practice a religion that requires the promised land and the temple when the temple has been destroyed and you are far from the promised land? So let me tell you a story about my daughter, Rosemary. You all know Rosemary. Most of you know Rosemary. You know she's got a bit of a personality to her. Yes? That's an understatement. She's now 10 years old, and whoo, she's got a personality on her. And I can tell you the number of times I've asked her to do something simple, and I get a big old pushback. Or I give her some advice, and she goes, "God, Mom, not the lecture again. This is so stupid. Why are you telling me this?" You would think she's not listening. And it worries me because a lot of these things are, you know, basic safety things. Don't play with fire. Don't set things on fire. Don't ride your skateboard without your helmet, right? Don't talk to strangers. These are basic things. So to have a child tell you, "You're stupid, I don't have to listen to this, this doesn't apply to me," is frightening sometimes, isn't it? Yeah. So one night when she was about 5 years old, my little girl decided to start passing blood in her stool. And of course it's 10 o'clock at night when these things happen. It never happens at like 8 o'clock in the morning when you can call the doctor and get an appointment same day. No, it happens in the middle of the night when you have to go sit in the emergency room and wait for 5 hours. How many of us have been in the emergency room waiting for 5 hours with a child? Mm-hmm. Yeah. How many of us have just been there waiting with a loved one? You know what it's like. Now imagine if you have a 5-year-old with you that was supposed to go to bed, you know, 6 hours ago, 7 hours ago. And so we're waiting and we're waiting and we finally get a room and then they decide they want to do tests and they're trying to figure out what's going on and the nurse comes in and they got to check the weight, but that's not the doctor. And then the doctor comes in and then the doctor's asking all the same questions the nurse asked and we're at the end of our rope because she's 5 and it's 3 o'clock in the morning by this point. So Tobit is interesting because he is a refugee. He's actually a displaced person. He was forcibly displaced during wartime when the Assyrians came in into northern Israel, into Samaria, and forcibly marched all of the people out. And so he is now living in Nineveh, which is the capital city of Assyria. And everything that can go wrong, goes wrong. He loses his job. He gets in trouble with the law. And he was following Jewish law, but that was contrary to Assyrian law. That's what got him in trouble. So now there's a price on his head. And so he goes into hiding for a little while. He's separated from his wife and his son, Tobias. He's really worried that in this hostile environment, there's no one for his son to marry. He's worried that he's not going to ever get any grandchildren. And then on top of all of that, because he can't work, he loses his eyesight in the weirdest possible way. He loses his eyesight. And so his wife goes off to work, which makes him feel like less of a man, so they start arguing with one another. And on top of all of this, a war breaks out, and he has sent money. They didn't have banks the same way we have banks now, so he had taken some of his money and left it with friends in other cities outside the kingdom. But with the war, the roads are blocked. And without a job, he runs out of money, and he can't get to his stashes. And so he gets to the point where he is actually suicidal. There's a whole long prayer where he prays to God, demanding to know why this is happening to him and asking him to end it all. "I wish I had never been born," he says. "I wish I had never been born." And so he hatches a plan. He figures if he's going to go anyway, if he can get his son and tell him where that money is, at least his son might be able to go get it, bring it back, and then he'll know that his son and his wife will be taken care of after he goes. And so he sends his son on this wild journey, and that is the story of Tobit, is actually his son that goes on this wild journey to go and try and find this money. So Rosemary and I are there in the emergency room. And the doctor decides they have to take some blood to test. Well, Rosemary flips. She's had it. She's done. And they want to stick a needle in her now. And she says, absolutely not. And she starts crying and she starts flailing. And this is all completely understandable because she's a 5-year-old and it's 3 o'clock in the morning. So the doctor says, you know what? I think we're going to need some extra help. I'm going to call for an orderly to help restrain her, they say. Yeah, they're going to call for an orderly to start to restrain her. And a few minutes later, this guy arrives, and he looks like he should be playing for the Dallas Cowboys. He's like 7.5 feet tall and built like a refrigerator. And he comes in. And you know things are going to go from bad to worse at that point. So Tobit has this moment that we heard today where he honestly thinks his time is over. And he has one last conversation with his son. What he thinks is the last conversation. And he tries to tell him everything that's important to him. Did you hear what he told him? He said multiple times, follow God, trust God, praise God, no matter what is happening in your life. Follow God, trust God, and praise God. That's faith. That's hope even in the darkest of times. He did not lose his faith. That's a powerful, powerful message to teach a child. He talks about giving to people in need all the time, no matter what. Share, share, share. It will bring you more blessings than you can imagine. He tells him not to marry any foreign women. Did you hear that? Yeah, well, now that's not the first or the only time you hear that little prescription in the Bible. And so it's easy to think that he's saying, you know what, foreign women are bad, you know, no intermarriage and these sorts of things. And to some degree, that's what he's saying. But I want you to imagine that you are a minority culture in a very small pocket of people living in a very hostile, larger culture. And all of your ways of life, all of your religious practices, all of your culture hangs by a thread. And if you marry someone outside of that culture, it could be gone in a single generation. What he's really saying is marry a life partner who will let you be you, who will share your values, and who will help you raise the children to carry on the traditions that are important, that cannot be lost. That has nothing to do with race or with skin tone or with language. That has to do with values and cultural traditions and preservation of what's most important to you. He says to treat those who are below you with kindness and respect and fairness. There will be times in your life when you have someone below you. Perhaps it's an employee, perhaps it's a child, perhaps it's a student. Treat them with fairness and kindness and respect. That's equality. That's striving for equality and balance of power. And at the very end, he tells him money isn't everything. Money isn't everything. It's how much you love God that will bless your life, not how much money you have. These are powerful lessons. Powerful lessons that he gives to his son before he goes off on this journey. So if this guy had even looked at her, if this orderly had even talked to her, even once, things might not have gone down the way they went down. But what he did instead was he walked up to her and he said, I understand we have a little problem in here. Now, she was laying on the bed, on the gurney or whatever they have in these hospital rooms. And what he did was he grabbed one side of the sheet and started to throw it over to roll her up like a cigar so it would pin her arms. And my daughter at 3 o'clock in the morning said, don't you touch me. You can't put your hands on me. That's my body. Don't you touch my body. You can't touch my body without permission. You take your hands off of me. And she kept saying this while he completely ignored her, threw the blanket over, and starts to roll her up. Now, I've spent my whole life teaching her about stranger danger, and about who has the right to touch her body, because I am a woman raising a daughter in the United States of America. And every time I tried to talk to her about that, I got, Mom, why are you lecturing me? Why are you telling me these things? This is so stupid. So at this point, the sheet is over her left arm, and she's lying down, and this 7-foot gorilla is hovering over her. And as he starts to roll her over so then her right arm will be pinned, you know what she says? I said no! And she swings wide, and she clocked him right in the jaw. And it was so hard, you could hear it ricocheting off the walls of the ER room. She hit him that hard, and he recoiled. And then he started this lecture, little girl, that's inappropriate. You can't put your hands on people without permission, he says. And he left. And my daughter looked me in the eye, and she said, Mom, I don't want to be restrained. I don't like the idea of them taking blood, but if they have to, I promise I'll stay calm and let them do it. But please don't let them roll me up. And the doctor said, well, I think we need a fresh orderly. And I said, no. She said she can handle this. We need to respect that. And she did. She let them take blood. She simpered. She didn't love it. But she stayed calm, and they were able to get the sample that they needed. So in this story, we see the classic archetype of the man who goes on a journey. And in the end, he finds not only money, but he also finds a wife who he rescues from certain demise. Someone, a good woman, who's also Jewish, who he can bring back to meet his dad. He brings her back, and everything is made right. His eyesight is restored. He and his wife reconcile and do fine. The neighbors that had been poking fun at him and ridiculing him suddenly respect him. He gets his money back so he's able to live and feed his family again. Everything is made right. Assyria's leadership turns over so it's a much more peaceful time, and so on. And when his sight is restored, he's not only able to see his son, but also his son's wife, which means that he can see his grandchildren. He can see the future again. He can see a way forward. He can see that his son has learned all that he taught him. He interpreted it differently. He's going to live his own life his own way. But he learned. And everything's going to be okay because nothing lasts forever. Nothing lasts forever. Nothing good lasts forever. Nothing bad lasts forever. All we can do is think about what's most important to us. What are our most valued traditions? What are our most core values in our life? And how do we convey those to our children, knowing and trusting that they will live on to interpret them in their own lives, in their own futures? So after everything calmed down, the blood was taken, and we were determining that she was going to be okay, and the orderly was gone, and the doctor had left, and we had some downtime. I took her out in the hall, and I was walking her. You know how mothers do, how fathers do. You have your child on your shoulder, and you're patting their back, trying to calm them down. And my daughter says to me, she says, Mommy, I don't know why that man told me it was inappropriate for me to hit him. I told him to take his hands off my body. And I had this vision of her at the age of 16 in the back seat of a car with a boy going, kapow. I don't know why you're upset. I told you to keep your hands off my body. And I knew she was going to be okay. She could handle anything life was going to throw at her. That everything that I tried to teach her, I didn't teach her to punch people out, but I did teach her she had the right to defend her body if it was under attack. She had internalized that. She understood it. And she could adapt it to her own circumstances. I went back to the doctor at one point, and I did not apologize for what my daughter did. But I did say, is your orderly okay? Is he okay? And you know what she said? She said, that's all right. Trust me, he had it coming. So this Father's Day, I urge you to remember the wise lessons that were taught to you by your father or by the healthiest father figure you had in your life. And I urge you to think of the lessons that you teach to the children in your life? What is at the core of what's important? What do you tell them about God? How do you teach them about your culture and your tradition, those things that are so sacred they cannot be lost? How do you convey to them how to love in this world and how to be in this world? Tobit's a wonderful example for that. If you thought this was the last time you had to tell them anything, what would you tell them? Go tell them that today. Don't wait. Don't wait. Can I get an amen to that?